This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Triple Bypass acknowledges that we broadcast from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. And to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people who are listening today, we acknowledge that this land was never ceded, no treaty was ever signed, and that it always was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
You need surgery.
Bisexuality.
Bisexual.
I'm bisexual.
Bisexual.
Triple bypass.
Bisexual.
Bisexual.
Bisexuality.
I'm bisexual.
Bisexuality.
The best of both worlds.
Triple bypass.
Triple bypass.
Triple bypass on Joy 94.9.
Tonight on Triple Bypass, it's our monthly sexual health episode, Sex by the By. I'm your host, Nat, and I'm joined by Ruby.
Hello, everybody.
And we are here to bring you your weekly fix of Bi-Plus community goodness with an added extra dollop of sex ed.
Well, it's a pretty generous dollop.
It is.
It's an encompassing dollop.
It's a robust dollop. And as the bisexual gods know, we all need an extra dollop.
Big ol' hefty dollop of sex ed.
Thanks heaps to the team at Bad Gays for another great show tonight. On Triple Bypass, we're talking sexual health negotiations on dating apps, and we'll be looking at some fresh research out of Swinburne University, which gives us a sneak peek at just what we're all doing on there, how we're negotiating our health and our safety and our well-being, and how we're having safer sex conversations on dating apps. And just a reminder that you can find Triple Bypass on our socials, Facebook,
Triple Bypass, Insta, Triple Bypass Joy. And our show is available as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and where all good podcasts are found.
Get us in your ear holes. And now it's time for some sexual health related news. Ruby?
One of Australia's leading sexual health academics says inadequate health services and a spike in syphilis and gonorrhea cases has thrust Australia into the grips of a sexual health crisis. Eminent Monash University professor Kit Fairley is the director of Melbourne's Sexual Health Centre and professor of public health at Monash University. He says Victoria is reaching a new STI epidemic without an accessible healthcare system, and people are being left behind. Melbourne Sexual Health Centre is reported as being the biggest in the nation. However, it is struggling to cope with demand. He says the caseload has quadrupled in 20 years with no apparent increase in resources. Professor Fairley says the idea of personal responsibility in things such as sexually transmitted infections is outdated. He says Australia tends to have a blame culture where if people become obese or catch STIs, it's their own fault. The outdated message to us in Australia relies too heavily on condoms and messages to stop having so many sexual partners. But all the studies show condom use is hard to change and you can't get people to have fewer partners. The Victorian State Government began a review into the state's sexual health services in September 2018 and it released a final report in October this year. It identifies a disproportionate burden of sexually transmitted infections hit the state's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, as well as gay and bisexual men, culturally and linguistically diverse communities, and those ineligible for Medicare and those living with HIV.
Well, it's not scary, I think, if we start talking about STIs in a way that encompasses communication and really does away with the idea of stigma. We know that the stigmatization of all kinds of STIs prevent people from talking about them. They prevent people from being tested. They prevent people from disclosing status or even, you know, finding out their STI status.
And that's why it's so important to have these conversations. And we're going to be playing a pre-recorded interview that we did, that you did earlier. And I got to be there and just like push buttons and fiddle around. It was great.
The important things though.
So important. But it was also so interesting because this was a lot of research around how we start to have these kinds of conversations on dating apps. Like how, if we're on Tinder and want to have a hookup, how do we say, by the way, just so you know, here's the barriers I like to use when we're having sex, or I prefer if you, have you had a test recently? Because I had mine this time and this is what I'm doing, and how you can have those conversations. And that wasn't the only data that came out of there. People also were talking about their experience of discrimination and everything. But it sounds like it was the how people have all developed strategies to have these conversations across all these different places, even though people still often see dating apps as a novelty because they are such a generational division.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And I think that the research that we're going to talk about in the interview is really exciting because it puts down in some concrete evidence stuff that we kind of, we're all, you know, most of us are experiencing in our day-to-day dating lives.
So excited by this concrete evidence.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's really, like, I noted out like a lot just sitting behind the huddle being like, oh my God, that's so interesting.
Yeah, and it covers a really broad, you know, there's so much, you know, stuff in there that, you know, we're really excited to share with everyone around, you know, the bi experience, bi pan queer experience, and also, yeah, some really interesting evidence around how we're having conversations about sexual health and when we feel comfortable doing that and the way that we do that via dating apps.
And so who are you talking to?
So we're talking to Professor Kath Albury, who is from Swinburne University of Technology. And Kath was in to discuss the research project that's called, what is it called?
Safety, Risk and Wellbeing on Dating Apps.
Thank you. Fantastic. Yep. And so this really put dating apps under the spotlight to ask how we navigate safety, health and wellbeing when we're using them. And we're really fortunate to have Kath in the studio because they've done a lot of really exciting research around the way we interact with digital media. So they're from the Digital Media and Communications School at Swinburne University.
They're also proof, I think, that people over, in her own words, people over 50 can actually learn to be quite fluent in the conversation standards that happen in these apps.
Exactly.
If you want to, you can learn and it won't seem so alien, it won't seem so new and novel when it's been around for over a decade.
Exactly. And so Kath's current research projects focus on young people's practices of digital self-representation and the role of user-generated media around in sexual health, so informal.
So how
sexual.
Are we using our own media content to learn more about sex?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, y'all want to hear more about that. So stay tuned. That's coming up after this break. Coming up next, we've got some community messages, then Mojo Juju with...
A Heart Is Not A Yo-Yo.
Stay tuned. This is Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9. About
the rules that they change and never stay the same. The thing about a heart is that it always plays a fickle game. How are we to know that we would always be alone? I was there to keep you warm, but it was just a passing stone. I hope you know that I do not have regret. Is this the
Fiona, and this is Triple Bypass's monthly sexual health and wellbeing episode, Sex by the By. For many of us, dating apps are a standard part of how we make our way through dating, hookups, and relationships. So what kind of practices do you engage in to ensure your health and safety when using dating apps? Have you ever experienced discrimination on an app? And what kinds of negotiations do you make with potential partners and yourself to ensure your interactions are ones that make you feel good? Joining me in the studio tonight to unpack this is Professor Kath Albury from the Department of Media and Communications at Swinburne University of Technology. Kath is also a program leader at Swinburne's Social Innovation Research Institute, or SIRI. Kath's current research projects focus on young people's practices of digital self-representation and the role of user-generated media in formal and informal sexual learning. She's interested in exploring new approaches to workforce training for health promotion and sexuality education professionals who wish to develop deeper engagement with digital media practices like sexting, selfies, and hookup apps. Her latest project is Safety, Risk and Wellbeing on Dating Apps, a new report which launched just a few days ago. The research was conducted over 2 years and was a partnership with Swinburne University, Acon Health, Family Planning New South Wales and the University of Sydney. It takes a closer look at how we are using dating apps and gives some more detail and nuance to how we experience sexual and mental health, safety and wellbeing while navigating hookups, dating and interactions through apps. Kath, thanks for joining us on Triple Bypass.
Hello, thank you.
Dating apps are a pretty standard part of life for many of us, not for everyone, but for many of us. Often the broader mainstream discussions around them don't necessarily capture that ordinary nature of them or get some of the nuance around how people are using them. And with that in mind, what sort of prompted the research investigation into safety and wellbeing on apps?
I had previously done some work with Paul Byron, who was involved in this project but now is at the University of Technology, Sydney, and we had looked at the ways that people negotiated safety on apps and the ways that they would do this by thinking about who they shared pics with, when they would and wouldn't message, and how they made themselves visible or kind of disconnected themselves in different spaces. And we were really interested in looking more at the ways that people negotiated safety in a kind of concrete way around their personal safety, so, you know, the safety from harassment and abuse, but also in relation to sexual health, negotiating condom use or not, the ways that people talked about contraception when they were meeting people on apps or dating. There was a lot of sexual health information and a lot of sexual health research around men who had sex with men, but there really wasn't that much in the literature about anyone else. So we were interested in working with these health promotion organizations to look at how app users were kind of negotiating the full spectrum of safety and risk when they were meeting new people through apps.
Yep, awesome. And so in moving forward with that, who did you want to speak to? Who is part of this research?
So we recruited through Facebook groups and through mailing lists associated with our professional reference groups in New South Wales. And we got a really broad range of people from different backgrounds, very broad spectrum of sexual identities and gender identities, and really much more diverse than previous health studies had looked at. The health studies tend to kind of really hone in on specific demographics usually, or specific, you know, risk populations. Ours was everyone aged 18 to 35 who used an app. If you fell into that category, you were eligible.
Yep. And at the launch of the report on Friday, you were really showing the kinds of apps that we're talking about when we're talking about dating apps. And the list was really long for the kinds of apps that people might have used. When you were doing these interviews, were you grouping them by the kinds of apps people were using?
Yeah. So when we went to do the recruitment, we really wanted to invite people to participate in conversations about app use that didn't lock them down according to gender identity. So we understood that there were non-binary people in our groups, for example, who might be on a Seeking Women app for a while and then a Seeking Men app for a while and might be changing their identity in the drop-down menu according to who they wanted to be seen by and who they wanted to see and how they wanted to navigate different spaces. So when we recruited, we didn't use the kind of standard we're seeking men who blah. We said we're seeking people who use apps like Grindr and Scruff. And that meant that we got more gender diversity in those groups. When it came to the women's groups in particular, how it turned out was we ended up with bi and pansexual women in all of our groups, including the straight identified groups, because people could self-nominate. Well, I use Tinder for meeting men, but I use her for meeting women. I'll just come to the group that's convenient for me on the night of the week, you know, and that was really valuable for us because people could compare their experience of dating or chatting or sharing pictures with people on different apps in different spaces at different times.
Yeah, I think when you were discussing the findings, I think automatically that was really refreshing because that is so, you know, obvious and true. And, you know, highlighting the fact that, you know, bi, pan, queer folk are across a range of groups and are using, and that's, you know, that we're a group that's across a lot of other groups as well, which I think is really important and something that's often missed in particularly sexual health promotion because, you know, the, I guess, projects or programs are so often focused, often very much towards gay men. But, yeah, there's sort of that nuance that we're perhaps not capturing in health promotion or health organisations.
Yeah, and I think that sexual and reproductive health organisations who target women are very poor at separating out the aspects of sexual health that have to do with reproduction, having babies, et cetera, or not having babies, and the aspects of sexual health that have that have to do with trying to work out how you want to mitigate against STI transmission, what kinds of barriers you want to use or don't want to use. There's not much acknowledgement that women in relationships with men might also be having sex with women or that they might be in a long-term relationship with a woman and then a long-term relationship with a man. And even though they turn up in a relationship with a man for a sexual health check, that doesn't mean that they don't also need information about sex with women.
Exactly.
Yeah, so in our study, people were very clear about wanting information about what safe sex means when you're having sex with women as well as when you're having sex with men.
Yeah, that's true. And I think for a lot of people, you know, dating apps may be the platform in which they're first potentially testing the waters in this area. And I think that people, you know, we're coming to dating apps with our sexual education that we've had. And as we know, that's very often lacking. And I think this is one area that it's kind of lacking in. So, yeah, I think it's so interesting because on dating apps, we often are, you know, it's a private experience in a way because it's not, you know, it's not like Instagram or Facebook where everyone can see what you're doing. It's really the chance to kind of be honest about what you want. I mean, after a while in the queer community, there's no anonymity, of course, but yeah. maybe at first, if you're first coming out.
Yeah, and I think, too, there were people who would have seen themselves as, and this is in the women's group particularly, a woman who has sex with women, but didn't see themselves as queer community aligned as
exactly.
well. So there were people using terms like heteroflexible
yep.
and talking about dating or being interested in hooking up with a diverse range of people, but they might not have access to queer community organisation in terms of sexual health information. So they wanted to see a broader range of information about sexuality on the quote unquote straight apps like Tinder or Bumble. They weren't necessarily on her and they weren't going to date. I mean, people were looking for the app that provided the broadest range of other people they might meet, and so they weren't necessarily going to be on a niche app. because that was a smaller pond, especially that's what the people in the regional community where we interviewed people were saying. It's a very shallow pond.
Oh, yeah. The pond is shallow.
Yeah.
I've lived there. another really good reason which affirms, you know, that viewpoint that all sexuality and sexual health information should have a bi-pan lens put over it, assuming that anyone, you know, may be engaging in, you know, sex with anyone of any gender at any point over their lifespan. It's information we can all use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we asked in the survey about people's desire to see contraceptive information, and we had a drop-down section, like an open field, asking them what other safe sex methods did they use, many people, you know, not a majority, but about 100 people who answered that survey said contraception was their other safe sex method. And that included gay and bi men. It included non-binary people. It wasn't just straight women who were saying that they included kind of contraception as part of their sexual health repertoire. And some health educators would see a health consumer, I guess, saying contraception is one of my safe sex methods as, oh, they have poor health literacy. Yeah. They have to understand that. So we took a different approach, saying, well, we allowed people to define what safety was in their terms, and if feeling safer for you is feeling like you're not going to have an unplanned pregnancy or an unintended pregnancy, then that's part of your safe sex repertoire.
Definitely. We'll be back with Professor Kath Albury after some community messages, but now here's Hayley Mary with The Piss, The Perfume. You're on Joy.
Hi, I'm Mara Wilson, former child actor, current writer, aspiring bicon, and you are listening to the show that puts the B in LGBTIQ. Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9.
The perfume always somehow to bring me to
That was Hayley Mary with The Piss the Perfume. You're listening to Triple Bypass's monthly sexual health episode, Sex by the By. We're talking safety, well-being, and negotiating risks and safer sex on dating apps with researcher Professor Kath Aubrey from Swinburne University of Technology. And if you ever want to get in touch with us on Triple Bypass to tell us about what you might be interested in us covering, you can email us at triplebypass@joy.org.au. Kath, I wanted to talk about the definition of the words safety, risk and well-being. They're often used in a certain context. How did the people that you interviewed for the research project define those?
Yeah, so we really wanted to let people define those terms for themselves. In public health data, basically everything's risk. Like, you know, you are just intrinsically at risk if you're sexually active in any way. We wanted to let participants talk about what felt risky for them and what made things feel safer. And so it was quite interesting to us if they could, you know, filter profiles, or if they could block people that they were uncomfortable with, or if they were, you know, feeling like they were too dependent on getting likes and matches. You know, they felt better or safer if they could take a break for a while or turn off push notifications. So people kind of had these sense of, you know, what you might term emotional safety, or safety in relation to sort of mental health or well-being. And then they would have safety issues that were around negotiating consent. And really everyone was quite concerned with consent as an aspect of sexual health. And this is not usually integrated into sexual health.
No, it is not.
Conversations, yeah, but it really was so clear. And it's kind of common sense. Like, if I can't negotiate the kind of sex I want to have and in what context, like, I really don't have much chance of discussing testing history or using barriers with you, because I'm already not in a place where I can have an open conversation about my needs or my boundaries or those kinds of things. So, and people of all genders and all identities and all sexualities were really clear that consent was about safety for them in terms of their sexual health, but in terms of, again, of well-being and feeling good in an encounter. And people talked about, you know, the things that you would expect to see in relation to safety around kind of personal safety. So how they negotiated meeting up for the first time, how they tried to determine the identity of the person they were meeting. So people talked about the ways they might connect their Instagram to a dating app or want to see someone else's Insta. There was one person who had a really interesting, what you might term like a two-stage identity verification. He said, I'm never going to someone's house if they send me their address on Grindr. I want to move to Instagram Messenger so that I've seen their photos and I know it's the same person that I was chatting to on the app. But if they'll send me their address on Insta Messenger, then I know that they are the person they say they are, and then I'll go to their house. But if they won't talk to me on Insta or send me the message from Insta, I don't trust them.
Yeah.
So people use different kinds of strategies to feel safer around meeting up. And everyone in all group kind of talked about that advice to, you know, meet in a public place or don't go to someone's house. But of course, everyone knew that was the ideal, but it was not necessarily a thing that everyone did in all instances.
Yeah, and that's not always necessary for how you're feeling at the time or the nature of, you know, your hookup or who you're meeting. The linking to Instagram. And does Tinder still link to Facebook? I feel like it used to. Does it still do that? Okay, I'm not sure. Having been on dating apps for a while. But it's interesting, that Instagram thing, because, you know, it can be a safety measure. Like, oh, I can see you. I can see what kind of life you have. I can verify that you're who you say you are. But I also find it interesting in terms of, you know, I've had a conversation with someone once and someone had seen their Instagram account through their dating app. They hadn't matched, but had then added them through Instagram, struck up a conversation there, had kind of, I guess, wormed in, which is not, you know, uncommon, I suppose, but in this particular instance, it was kind of an unwanted contact.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the other side of it as well.
A couple of people did mention that in the workshops, that they didn't link deliberately didn't link to social media because they wanted control over who they chatted to and didn't chat to, and they didn't want someone they hadn't matched with messaging them. And similarly, there was a guy who talked about hiding any paperwork or, you know, envelopes or ID when trade came over, basically, not because he was worried about theft or people stealing stuff from him, which some people do when they're having, you know, a hookup come over, but he didn't want people adding him on Facebook afterwards, so he preferred they didn't know his last name.
That's very, no, I can appreciate that level of vigilance. Kath, some of the research highlighted findings around discrimination and harassment through dating apps. And I just wondered if whether you might be able to talk about what was significant in this for bisexual community and also the trans and gender diverse community, of which there's often a crossover.
And there was definitely a crossover in our study. And it seemed to us, and I've got to say I'm a qualitative researcher, so I only know the kind of breakdown of the stats that other people have done for me, but it definitely looked like women in general experienced more harassment or discrimination in relation to sexuality, like their sexual identity, and when we drilled down, it was more likely to be bi or pan women who were reporting that. And similarly, there were a few people who were non-binary or trans and also bi and pansexual who reported just really intrusive comments, fetishizing of their body, really harassing questions about their genitals. There were a few women too in the workshops who talked about experiencing biphobia on women's apps. So they were having quite hostile comments about, oh, you're just experimenting, I don't want to be your first. And there was the usual, and again, expected, there was a kind of concern among women on the four women apps like her that they were being contacted by people who were trying to arrange a sneaky threesome without being overt about that. Sure. And then they felt kind of harassed in relation to what was a kind of, in a sense, a non-consensual negotiation. It wasn't something they were open to, or maybe they were open to it, but it was being presented to them in a potentially deceptive way that made them uncomfortable.
I think that's something that's so common anecdotally and within conversations as well. So good to see that represented, but you know, I think it's important to have those experiences documented so that we can learn from that information. In some, talking about that discrimination and harassment, were there measures in place, or did that alter the safety or the behaviour that people would undertake, particularly by people in those instances, to make themselves feel safer with those interactions?
And we've seen it in other research too. There were some people who did not describe themselves as bi on apps. So if they were on Tinder, they didn't say that they were bi anywhere in their profile, even though they might be open to seeking men and seeking women. On women's apps also, people would take off a kind of bi or pan identifier. There also is a kind of switching that some people did. So there was a person who was non-binary and would log in and out of Tinder at different times. So they would go on as a woman seeking women or a man seeking men, so that they were basically only ever in a kind of queer bubble. They were not being shown to straight cis guys, and that was their, they said that worked really well for them.
Which is actually a really important safety measure. I wasn't going to get to that bit yet, but this research did highlight some of the stats around straight cis men being seen as responsible for the majority of this any discomfort or
And it wasn't just straight cis men. I mean, gay cis men were were in one of the workshops. We had a lot of trouble recruiting, and that was because a bunch of the local trans guys in that area went, well, we get the most grief or harassment from gay cis men, and so we're not necessarily going to be wanting to share our experiences in a workshop with them. That wasn't universal, and certainly, you know, lots of the gay men in the workshops were very happy to kind of talk about gender in a really open and relaxed way. But there were there was definitely a kind of throwaway reference in many of the workshops to people's primary concern being cis heterosexual men who were either intruding on spaces where they weren't invited or they weren't expected. So concerns about catfishing by cis straight men on queer women's apps, or just a sense that on apps like Tinder that people were more concerned about chatting or meeting or hooking up with straight men and had more safety strategies in place.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be back with Professor Kath Aubrey to talk more about dating apps and how we keep ourselves safe and also what that means for sexual health promotion strategies. We'll be right back. You're on Joy. Coming up here's In My Mind with Alice Ivy and Eka Vandal. In My Mind by Alice Ivy featuring Eka Vandal. You're on Joy 94.9 and you are listening to Triple Bypasses, Sex by the By, Joy's home of all things bisexual, sexual health and sexual education. We're talking to Professor Kath Aubrey tonight from Swinburne University of Technology about a new report relating to dating apps, risk, health, safety and well-being. And we've been having a bit of a look at some of the bi-specific stats as part of that. What a surprise! Bi and pan and queer people were all over this report in many different groups. just there infiltrating in every corner. But I wanted to have a chat to you, Kath, about some... We were talking a little bit before the break around harassment and discrimination that people may experience on dating apps. And I wanted to talk a bit about the experience of those living with perhaps a disability or, you know, mental health issues. And also those who were on dating apps living from the experience of being a refugee or migrant background and how that kind of was reflected in the data.
Yeah, so we did, we had in the survey a statistical measure that looks at experience of disability. So it was a measure on, you know, how people were basically getting around, and also a small measure that looked for experiences of anxiety and depression. And again, unsurprisingly, people who had a kind of higher rating on those scales reported more experiences of discrimination and harassment, and also wanted more resourcing on apps in terms of negotiation and sexual health information and information about consent. So people were quite... It's hard to tell in that kind of research because it's quantitative. It's not about the kind of everyday ins and outs or nuance of people's lives. But there was definitely a sense in which if people had other areas of their lives where they were marginalized or they were kind of disabled by the circumstances around them, they were also having a more difficult experience on the apps in relation to the other people on the apps as well, and having a harder time negotiating the apps. People had lots of strategies for mitigating that stuff in the qualitative workshops. So people talked very directly about their experiences of mental health in relation to the apps. And for some people, it was really positive. So one of our group members talked about the ways that the apps were helpful for them around their social anxiety. So they said, you know, if I'm out at a community event, it's not necessarily going to be easy for me to just walk up to someone that I think is cute. But if we've matched and chatted on the app and I know they're at the event, it's not like a formal date, but I still know they like me.
Yep.
And it's just going to be easier to say hi and have that conversation. And so for a few people, they had, you know, clear strategies around this has helped me in relation to managing my mental health or anxiety around dating or experiences of, you know, meeting new people, making friends, flirting, social connection, those kinds of related things. But then there were other people who said they could remember times where the use of apps was not great for their mental health. They might have felt like they were very over-invested in matches, and when they weren't matching, they were really disappointed, or they were matching a lot but it wasn't turning into anything, or they were matching but they felt like the people that were matching with them didn't want the same thing they wanted, and they were having a frustrating experience, like, yeah, I know I'm hot, but I'm not looking for a quick hookup right now. I want a relationship, and this is just making me feel bad. And so people were using strategies like just turning off push notifications so they didn't feel like they had to check all the time if anything had happened, or just taking a break, uninstalling the app because they just needed their headspace back, or moving to a different app. So if the culture on a specific app turned out to be not the thing they were looking for, they might move to a different app that a friend had recommended that was a little more comfortable for them to navigate.
Yeah, that is so interesting because that is, you know, thinking about, you know, just discussions with friends, that kind of a golden period on dating apps where you're getting lots of matches and the conversation's really great and you may have had a couple of really great dates, and then, you know, like that real sort of trough where you're like, I'm uninstalling everything, this is making me anxious.
Yeah.
And it is interesting also to talk about that difference in culture from dating app to dating app because... Yeah, I think that's definitely something that, you know, is common. It's like, oh, I've got to get off, say, you know, like one particular dating app because it's just, you know, a majority of this group of people and I'm encountering a, you know, fair bit of harassment or discrimination or just like yucky interactions. And yeah, that's something that I've personally definitely noticed in the past is like, oh, this app feels a bit nicer or it feels a bit safer or there are more of, you know, people I feel comfortable with here.
Yeah, and similarly for people... with migrant experience or their first language wasn't English. There were people who were quite disappointed in their experience of apps. So there was a guy in one of our reference groups who talked about his disappointment as a migrant wanting to meet his community, like he was hoping it would be a way for him to meet his community, and people were blocking him on Grindr, and he was like, you're not even allowing me to be visible in your space. And that was very disheartening to him. So there were people who experienced a sense of exclusion or being unwelcomed in the space where they were hoping to find their community. But again, with those people, they had various strategies for moving to different apps where they felt that the environment was more welcoming or it would be friendlier. It was interesting, and it's not actually reflected as much in other research, so it's something we need to look at more. But in the group of the acronym is culturally and linguistically diverse in health world, which is problematic, but that's what we ended up using in the survey. The men from those categories who were having sex with men were more likely to want information about PrEP through the apps.
Yep.
And we were wondering, because of kind of some of the other research coming out about international students and migrants, recent migrants to Australia, we were wondering if that was because of the age group we were recruiting, kind of younger guys who were getting a sense of a different access to healthcare here or different possibilities around sexual health and HIV prevention, and would have liked to have seen more information about that on the apps. We don't know that some of that was from the survey data, so we don't know why they wanted more PrEP information, but it was just kind of interesting that people had specific needs based on other aspects of identity other than, you know, sexual identity.
Yes, and I think that potentially for, in terms of international students, say young gay men who are, because I think the messaging around PrEP gets through because it's a definite message. It's, it's kind of cut and dry. It's like, this is a medication, this is a prescription that you can have, you can take this and this is what it does. Where I think, you know, if we're talking that more broader range of STIs or sexual health in general, it can get a bit murky and potentially, you know, in terms of that cohort of international students, it's maybe not, hasn't, or that, you know, I think health orgs have traditionally had difficulties in understanding where that messaging needs to be.
Yeah, sex education, like school-based sex education, is so different in different countries.
Oh, completely.
So the baseline knowledge that people have is going to be completely different depending on where they went to high school.
Yep.
So, yes, that certainly came out in our data.
Yeah. And I think you did touch on this in the research, looking at whether participants had ever seen any sexual health promotion on dating apps. And I think, was it queer men who sort of reported the highest, highest number of having seen
that. Men, and it would have been the men, you know, primarily who were on apps like Grindr and Scruff, and non-binary people who were on the Seeking Men apps also had seen much more health information. Women in every other group were, like, only about 16% of them had seen any sexual health information on apps, and similarly, straight men. Yep. Only about 16% of them had seen health information. So,
and did those
apps
people
like Tinder
want
and
it?
Bumble, some did, some didn't. Mm. Some would have felt it was intrusive. I mean, it was interesting in terms of talking about how people might want to negotiate safe sex or consent. Some people really didn't want to do that on an app or in messaging, because, and it was interesting for us to look at that data in more detail, because some people felt like, well, if I negotiate all this before I meet you, have I signed a contract in a sense to do, we'll do X at 12 o'clock, we'll do Y at 12:05, and what if I meet you and the chemistry's not there and I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But for other people, they just felt like it was too much, it was too awkward, it's a conversation they'd rather have face to face, but there was still the majority of participants who would have liked some information on the app that they could use potentially to start that conversation, whether that conversation happened through messaging or in a different, over a coffee or a beer or whatever.
Yeah. And I think we organically just kind of drop those things in conversation that give us a clue as to whether the person would be receptive to talking about, you know, like whatever aspect of safer sex or, you know, consent there is. But yeah, I think, yeah, sometimes via message, you know, it can seem too soon. And also, you know, messaging is such a weird, you know, dating apps are so, they're so weird because, you know, you could be talking to someone for, say, a couple of weeks without having met them, maybe, like, depending on, you know, who you're speaking to or how soon you're going to meet them. But, you know, conversation can get so intimate and familiar quite quickly, and I think that can make this conversation around, you know, safer sex or consent or communication or whatever confusing because, you know, there can often be this, like, assumed familiarity or not a sense of owing someone something, but just like that level of comfort. And then you're like, oh, well, I feel awkward bringing this up now yeah. because, you know, we've been getting along so well and I feel like we've got this really great dynamic happening. And
yeah. So, yeah, there were some people who were worried about like, I'll ruin it.
Yeah, it throws it off balance.
Yeah. And then there was someone, there was another woman who was really interesting who was an interviewee, so talked a lot more in detail. And she was bi in a relationship with a man and she and her partner were on apps as a couple seeking a third and were being, she was doing it like very openly and based on her experiences as a bi woman on apps, you know, had to do
yeah.
better.
Yeah.
But she said she had an experience where a woman they were potentially going to meet up with initiated a safer sex and testing conversation as the first conversation. And she said she found that really confronting because it was like we haven't really established yeah. a rapport or
yeah.
a mutual interest, and suddenly I have to talk about when I last had a test and I feel like it's too soon. So it kind of works both ways. It's both it's gone too far, we have too much rapport yeah. and I might ruin it, or we have zero rapport and we're suddenly talking about
yeah.
you know, really intimate.
I don't really want you to know about my testing status because we've literally just haven't even ordered coffee
exactly.
yet.
Exactly,
like, yeah.
exactly.
It's, yeah, yeah, you need a bit of time.
Tricky, yeah.
I guess just moving on beyond participants and thinking about the impact of this research and how it might sort of assist our sexual health care system, I guess it really affirmed for me when the findings were presented that sexual health organisations and clinics and, you know, the medical system needs to, and education needs to sort of look at that current definition of sexual health and really start putting policies in place that broaden its scope beyond just that kind of clinical condoms, you know, and testing. Just interested on what you think about why there's been a gap in that space so far. Is that because we've just been dictated to by sort of health department
yeah,
outlook?
Yeah, I think there's a, and I'm coming from the New South Wales context, which is different to other states. I think there's a history of siloing in departments of health where, you know, this department pays for the respectful relationship education and this other department pays for the sexual health checks. And if we start talking about respectful relationships in the sexual health clinic, well, we're paying for that department's project and that's, you know, that's their work. It's not our work. But obviously in the lived experience of a person who is sexually active, I don't need to go to two different locations to talk about
yeah.
different aspects of my sex life. I'm doing it all in the same relationship. And so what you might term a more user-centered approach to sexual health, I think, could be really helpful for a lot of organisations. And also, and this was really clear in the sexual health research, you know, dating apps have now been around for a long time. They're not a novel technology, which is yeah. the way they're often talked about in public health discourse. It's like, this is a novel and innovative technology that blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, it's very ordinary.
Yeah.
It's as ordinary as Facebook.
Yep.
And it just, you know, and one of our participants framed this really well, and I don't have the quote at the top of my head, but she's like, it's just part of dating.
Yep.
It doesn't need to be special health promotion or niche health promotion, just mention it in the context of other things you're talking about in relation to sexual health.
And that's so important, I think, for education, particularly if we're talking about education of young people who are still in the school system as well. It's, yeah, knowing that, I guess it depends on the level of comfort that perhaps the educator has with discussing that. And I know that if an educator's older, maybe it seems like something that's so far beyond their scope, and it does seem like...
Yeah, and that's why I'm quite interested in working with organisations. Like, I'm 52 and I have been with my partner for 15 years. We didn't meet on a dating app, but I still have managed to negotiate this space because there are resources available and people to talk to, and I can learn from them. So I would encourage people who are worried that they didn't grow up doing this, I would encourage them to access the resources that are available or the research that's available and, you know, learn something new. And listen to dating app users, which is what was the strength of this project for us.
Yeah. And people can get in touch with you to sort of incorporate this work and this research into their health promotion strategies.
Yeah. Our reports are available online. They're open access from the Analysis and Policy Observatory, which is an open access portal associated with Swinburne. But I'm really happy to be contacted through the Swinburne website to talk to or with specific groups that, you know, so, you know, health promotion is different from sex education, which is different from clinical health services. And I know that, and I'm really happy to talk about the specific needs of different groups.
Professor Kath Aubrey, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Pleasure.
That's it for us tonight on Sex by the By. Nat and Ruby are signing off. We'll be back in 1 month on New Year's Eve for the next episode of Sex by the By, and Triple Bypass will be back next week.
Yeah.
Don't go anywhere, though. We've got some retro soul grooves coming up, courtesy of Soul Provider and Matt. So stick with us on Joy 94.9.
Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.